reach the Outrider Podcast. Hello, and welcome to this special episode of the Outrider Podcast. Normally, this day we would have an interview or another one of like the Shop Talk episodes or something like that. But as I am working to develop some new content streams for the podcast, including some recurring conversations with a friend of mine, Stephen McClurg, who's a poet and making a name for himself quietly but massively as a scripter for graphic novels. Shh, I can't tell anyone. And then I also have another stream that I'm working on with a friend of mine, Gavin Pate, the author of the novel The Way to Get Here. His short fiction has appeared in a number of journals, and he's been anthologized in an anthology called Warmed and Bound, which comes out of the Velvet website. What else? So yeah, I'm doing some stuff like that. But if you're following the literary news out there, probably seen articles about this little dust-up between, I'm going to say the name wrong, Kazuo Ishiguro and Ursula K. Le Guin, because apparently Ishiguro said something that Le Guin thought was denigrating towards fantasy, and so she got all up in arms about it. And so there have been a lot of articles lately, since February, about, not a lot, but a few, four or five, about you know, the genre wars, or the end of the genre wars, and so forth. And I thought that this dust-up sounded a lot like conversations that I used to have with my friend Jen Zukowski back in graduate school, because she was a champion of genre, particularly fantasy. And at the time, I was a snob. Not that I'm not a snob now. I mean, I am still kind of a snob. But at the time, I kind of fit into this type that that was mostly defined by a comment that the writer Brian Evanson once had in a workshop. He said that young, unpublished writers tend to develop a very rigid aesthetic, because that aesthetic is the only thing they have to justify their existence to their parents. And so I had a rigid aesthetic regarding genre. And occasionally it would annoy Jen. And so we would go out and drink pitchers of beer and discuss genre and literary, or literary as genre, and hash all this out. And this was 15 years ago, and it seems that people are still debating that. Particularly, you know, Ishiguro and Le Guin. Some literary writer being afraid that their book is going to be put into one of the genre ghettos, and then one of the people who has mastered, who is an acknowledged genius of that genre, taking offense. And that's what happened here. So Jen and I decided we would talk about it and share that conversation with you. So here we are. Now, there are some internet problems with this episode. The audio cuts in and out in some spots. You'll hear those. I cut out the biggest chunk of it, but most of them were pretty quick because we were right on it, handled it all pretty quickly. So we left those in there. I don't know what it is with my conversations with Jen. Our audio levels always seem to be wonky, and I think it's because we both have a weird ability for our voices to carry. That's strange. I think it's because she's a theater person and I'm an awkward dork. Anyway, so let's get right to it. Here's my conversation with my friend Jen Zukowski about the genre wars inspired by the dust-up between Kazuo, I knew I was going to do it, Ishiguro and Ursula K. Le Guin. Let's get to it. Here we are with our special episode.
Yeah.
So for those who probably haven't had the pleasure of listening to episode one, And I'll give a little introduction thing, you know, in the the monologue beforehand, but real quick, tell everybody who you are.
Oh gosh, hi, I'm Jen. I don't even know what to say. I teach literary arts, theatrical arts, and all kinds of stuff.
Are you still teaching at Metro and at DU?
Metro, DU, Regis, Front Range.
All over the place.
And if you've heard anything about the recent adjunct faculty walkout day, you'll understand my plight.
Yes, I do.
Yeah,
Now, are you still teaching classes, lit classes on fantasy and sci-fi and things like that?
I am not because the departments where I teach usually don't have the space for offering such things.
But you did for a while, right?
I did for a while. I had classes at, especially at DU, I had classes on writing fantasy. I had classes on writing. I had classes that were themed like the trickster, the fairy tale. I had lit classes that were Harry Potter themed and Tolkien themed, Lord of the Rings. And I
Right on.
really wish I could go back and teach those again, but they're like, we don't have time in our semesters because people are taking things that are more practical and blah, blah, blah. So.
Blah blah blah. Right. And of course you are a writer of fantasy and
Yes.
fun things like that.
Fun things. I just read some of my old stuff recently at an author's reading for the faculty at Front Range. It was interesting. I literally dusted off some of the old pirates, like literally, and the pages were yellowed, and it was
Oh wow.
hilarious. And I saw all my old markings on it, and I was like, the last time I read this little chapter out loud was at Naropa in, that would have been 2001.
It would have
Maybe
been.
I should go through and edit this stuff again. It's pretty good. People want to read about pirates still, don't they?
Sure. Yes. Now, of course, we came together because you sent me. We decided to record this tonight because you sent me
Yes.
the Esquire article by, let's
Yes.
see, I have it here as well.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at the author too. This is the one where you're like, we should record our talk that we always used to have talks like this. I'm not seeing an author. Are you?
Stephen March.
Oh, where do you? Oh, I see. I'm Stephen
Right, Stephen
Marche.
March. How genre fiction became more important than literary fiction, and
Yes.
this was actually the second article that I had seen that talked about the dust up between Kazuo Ishiguro, and
Ursula Le
actually
Guin.
I feel like I'm never saying his name right, and Ursula Le Guin, because Ishiguro was concerned that people would pick up his new book, The Sleeping Giant, and immediately put it down because it was fantasy.
Yeah, or at least sort of label it fantasy. To which
Which.
Le Guin was like, well, of course they should, and screw you for not wanting that to be happening. And she's like, by the way, it is fantasy and it sucks.
Yeah,
And
that's
it's
what I
like,
thought was
okay.
funny, was that she got all defensive about him worrying about it being fantasy, and then she tells him it's not fantasy. I was like,
Actually, her metaphor was it's hearing him complain about that is like watching a tightrope walker fall off and then say, will they call me a tightrope walker?
right, and it was like
Oh, okay.
you didn't. I understood her frustration at one point, but then by the end of it, I was like, Ursula, you didn't do yourself any favors.
Well,
Again,
and she's been a long time sort of scrappy defender of fantasy, especially fantasy as a genre.
right.
Her book, Language of the Night, is one of her most famous works. It's a collection of essays, and some of them are kind of dated at this point, but they're actually all speak to this. And that some of them they still have issues that come up. But my main thing
Right.
about this article was that, I mean, they're like, the genre wars are over. Like any no one but an idiot or a snob would ever think down on genre work. And actually, no one but idiots or snobs ever did. And now it's more everyone knows that genre work is good, and this is not even an issue. And my question was like, well, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if the genre wars are over. This is other article, one of the ones that you sent me. I had such good
Right.
homework to do. It was so fun.
Yeah,
One of them
well.
was like the genre wars are over and the detectives, the dragons, and the robots won, or something like that. And I was like, right. I'm not sure that's true, actually. I mean, I don't know.
I don't think good writing won or lost. Good writing remains the same no matter what shelf it's put on in the bookstore. And just so to get everybody, because I've mentioned this in other podcasts with other people, you and I have been having, well, this dust up and the way it was presented in these articles, and then of course some of the other articles that I sent you, which are older than this dust up between Ishiguro and Le Guin,
right?
You know, also talk about the genre wars and try to draw these lines and distinctions.
But, and I wouldn't even call it genre wars. I would call it genre writing tends to be denigrated as a whole thing. Just
the genre insurgency.
I don't know. There's kind of bullying, I guess. It's like a bullying. Because yeah. It's like, you know, all fan. Oh, since it's fantasy, it must suck. That's the thing. It's not really a war. It's more of a, oh, well, that's, you know, it's about dragons, so it automatically is going to suck. That's a detective story. It automatically is not going to be high art, which has never been true. And I've been talking about this for nearly 20 years now.
Well, that was the thing. It was that immediately there were two things that came to mind when I read the first article and then the one you sent me, was that didn't Jen and I figure this out 15 years ago?
Yeah.
And you know, it's only because we don't have famous names that no one's talking to us about us. So I figured we'd talk to each other. The other thing it reminded me of, the other thing that whenever people talk about this, whenever I read stuff about it, I get the same feeling that I get when I hear people debate spanking. And it's what? And well, I feel like one person, because inevitably in that conversation, one person interprets the word spanking as, you know, closed fist, beating your child, using a belt or a spoon or a ruler, you know, and leaving bruises and marks and actual physical trauma. You know, actually diagnosable physical trauma. And the other person's going, no, I'm talking about the time when your mother says, no, don't do it, and you do it. And then she says, I told you not to do that, don't do that, and you do it again. And so she turns you around and with the palm of her hand slaps your ass. You know, it's the same thing that in a different context is considered, you know, a way of congratulating someone. You know, baseball players, football players, you know, slap their teammates' ass. Good job! And it also, I mean, and that's how the other person in the debate is interpreting spanking, right? Which is this kind of, it depends on the circumstance as to whether or not it's discipline or, you know, praise. And the other person is going, spanking? Well, that's synonymous with, you know, punching and kicking and beating and flogging. And it's like,
it's the synonymous with, I think, is the key there.
Right.
It's and, like, if it's under the fantasy sci-fi, it's synonymous with pulp.
Right.
And don't get me started about the fantasy.
And what happens is that the people that, like you and I, when we first had this debate, that's what I thought we were, this is why I compared it to the whole spanking debate, is because we were talking past each other because we were interpreting the language at different levels.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I think it took us a while to kind of establish the facts. It's like, no, Jen, I grew up reading science fiction. You know, I don't have an adventure stories. I don't have a problem with it. But, and, you know, this was the thing that I found some of the other articles kind of brushed up against. And whenever, I think, I don't remember who exactly mentioned it, but they talked about the persistence of cliche.
Yes, exactly. Well, and what the lovely Anselm Hollow, may he rest in peace, said to me about my work in grad school was, it's determinedly derivative, which tends to be a stereotype of fantasy in particular.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
and I think that is the problem with the more strictly defined genres like fantasy or science fiction or detective. And, you know, some people like to say that literary isn't really a genre because it sprawls all over the place and whatever. And that's a nice way of saying, of kind of also at the same time passing a value judgment. And then it's also a way of I think of it as kind of the white privilege version of literary thinking.
Okay.
Is that the persistence of cliche is really easy to spot when you have something extraordinary, you know, the good-hearted brave hobbit.
Or the world building kind of falls apart. It's easier to see it when the world is not the realistic world of
Right.
how we know it.
Whereas in literary fiction, the persistent cliche is buried under the fact that that persistent cliche exists in the work and in the real world. You step over it on the way to work, right? And so it's just as easy to dismiss the pile of shit on the way to work as it is to dismiss it in literary fiction. You know, and that's, and we'd talked about that several times over the years, is that, you know, what we call literary fiction is just as bound up and constricted by what it cannot do as any, you know.
Well, and this is what I teach when I teach genre to especially my children's lit students. It's like, okay, so I think one of these articles you sent me actually talked about literary fiction as social realism, which I love that term. That just makes a lot of sense to me. And there's things that realism can do really well. I mean, and so that's there's some things that realism can do, contemporary realism or social realism can do that fantasy can't. And it's great. It gives you a mirror or a window into a world. And it's a contemporary realistic world. And there's nothing wrong. That's some things that can do well. But there are some things that fantasy can do that realism can't.
Exactly.
And it's... There's crappy books in any genre. This is what I was saying.
I'm sorry, I lost you there for a second. Hello, I lost you there. Nope, that's still working. Okay.
Oh, are you back?
You're back.
Okay. And so you look on the shelf and you look under just fiction and you see a ton of Danielle Steele and you see Dan.
Oh, I
who's
lost.
A real bestseller, right?
Right.
And then you see, then you maybe like if you walk up to a fiction shelf at a bookstore and you grab randomly 10 books off that shelf, probably 9 of them will suck. Most likely.
Yeah.
Same thing with the fantasy / sci-fi shelf, which pisses me off no end. Don't even get me started on the fantasy / sci-fi. The two genres do completely different things. They are totally different things that they're anyway.
Right.
But you do the same thing, and of course, 9 out of 10 are going to suck. And so, but it's just this thing where the label itself means okay, so that's for children or that's for nerds. And so my question was, especially with this, the Maurice the Esquire article, which is like, well. Are the genre wars over? Is that stigma still there?
Right.
Or is it just a matter of geek culture being more mainstreamly acceptable now? Mainstreamly? Is that a word? It is now.
It is now.
like, I don't know if the genre wars are over. I still think that there is a stigma. Like, if I open up a fantasy book and I'm sitting on the subway, people are going to think a certain thing about, you know, my literary tastes.
Right.
Unless I'm opening, you know, if I open up literary fiction, they're going to think another thing. Which might be similarly false. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't know that the genre war, the labeling, I guess, it's not really genre wars, it's labeling, I don't think that's done. I think more that the nerdy shit is more acceptable. I think the whole thing started with Harry Potter, to be honest. As much as I know there are lots and lots of flaws in the Harry Potter books, IMO. That was this, I think, the start of where people could sit, like, I take a commuter bus to and from.
Are you sure it was Harry Potter and not?
Well, that was one of the biggies because you'd see adults, kids, suits and students. I always see the suits and the students on my commuter bus on the way to Denver a couple times a week.
Right.
All of them were reading Harry Potter and they weren't hiding it behind their Wall Street journals either. They were actually just reading Harry Potter without even. It wasn't even an issue, you know? So that was one of, I don't think it was maybe not the first one, maybe that was brash to say, but it was certainly one of the biggies where it was like, okay, so.
Whoops, you lost. I lost
everybody
you.
Can read Harry Potter and it's okay.
You're cutting out a little bit.
Oh, are you? Okay, it says I'm here.
Yep, I still see you.
Okay.
You were there for a while before, but you were cutting out
Okay.
there for a minute.
I was. Okay.
Are
Well, I
you
don't know.
sure that Harry Potter, well, I mean, I kind of want to think, I want to push back the initial beginning acceptance. I mean, I don't think it was an overnight,
No,
one
no.
thing. I think it was a gradual thing. And for me,
Yeah.
I want to put the beginning of the acceptance of science fiction and fantasy as into the canonical, academic classroom. I don't know what would have precipitated it so much, but I mean, in the early 90s, I had a one of my lit professors when he taught the a class on the modernist included, Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler.
Right, yeah.
And I had another professor that taught an entire class on 20th century British science fiction.
Oh, cool.
I mean, we read H.G. Wells, Olaf Stapleton, J.G. Ballard, Arthur C. Clarke, Anthony Burgess, Angela Carter, Catherine Burdekin, all these really, interesting mid-century, early and mid-century pieces of British science fiction. That was an upper-level lit class.
So, do
And
you think it happened in academia first before the popular surge?
well, my thing is that I think the interest and legitimacy of science fiction probably got started with the rise of directors like Spielberg and Lucas and Kubrick, maybe even as far back as the 60s, when Kubrick made Clockwork Orange. And didn't he also direct Arthur C. Clarke's 2001?
Yes.
I think that was probably because here you had these pieces of science fiction, that I don't think had been taught in the classrooms, getting a serious artistic and significant treatment by a film
Yeah, but weren't those
that
movies
highlighted
weren't those
their.
movies still genre movies? Like, weren't they still just meant for the nerds still?
Right,
Do you know what I mean?
but you're talking about a set of directors whose oeuvre over the years, oeuvre or whatever they call it. I took Russian.
Oeuvre.
Oeuvre. I took Russian. What the fuck, I mean, so their body of work over the years lent the things that they did, even in genre, a certain air of intellectual seriousness.
Yes, well, that's definitely true. But I mean,
And so.
even though critics acclaim it and stuff, it's still the stigma of, oh, that's just a sci-fi, that's just a spaceship movie.
Right, but what I'm saying is those were the first steps
Oh, I see. Yeah.
that took science fiction out of the cartoons and the serialized shorts, the
Yeah, okay,
Flash
I
Gordon
see.
shorts and the comic books and put them and treated them with seriousness.
And now all comic books are called graphic novels because it's
Right.
considered okay.
But Clockwork Orange, 2001, even Spielberg's, what was it, THX or whatever it was, that
No, Lucas.
his,
THX1138?
yeah.
That's Lucas.
And I mean, because and then you had, well, even that movie Capricorn One and other stuff, which took these certain genre stuffs and began to treat those movies with some, began to treat those topics with some intellectual seriousness that was never attributed to the Flash Gordon serials before, that aired before movies, that played before movies,
Yeah.
the matinee serials.
Yeah, those are pulp stuff,
Right.
yeah. But then what comes out of that, like for example, Star Wars,
Oh, exactly.
there's a certain artistry plus the insane fandom, which kind of like combines
Right.
the artisticness with the popularity.
Yeah, so I think I want to say that it's been a process throughout the 20th century of a legitimizing process for genre.
It's still a process.
Yes, it is still a process, but I think part of the reason that... I think there are two things that are going on at the same time, and they're kind of counterbalancing each other, is that throughout the 20th century, we had a decline in, and I think one of the articles we read talked about it, this decline of public literary criticism. You know, as the as the book pages, you know, declined and dried up, we stopped having this, I guess, a moderating voice, much like we do with film criticism, which seems to be all over the place right now.
Right, but it's more like anyone can talk about the book. Yeah, it's not just the certain scholarly few that are reviewing them and telling you whether they're good or not. It's like anyone is just on there talking about it.
Right. So you have this decline of this. So you're losing the arbiters, the
right, the elitists.
the so-called elitists. But then again, you know, the elitists, we can denigrate them for on one thing because they maybe didn't take something seriously that we think they should have.
But they also had aesthetic standards as well,
right,
which we're having a lot less of now too.
Right. And that was the thing, is that the good stuff that they did decide to write about was legitimately good and remains so. Then the counterbalance to that decline of public literary criticism, we have the upsurge of what do we want to call it?
I would call it postmodernism, because it's, or even post-postmodernism, because it's the idea of anybody is an artist, or
right,
you know, taking down the canon sort of thing.
Right.
Anyone who has an authentic expression is an artist, which isn't true, or well, maybe it's true, but not everyone's a good artist.
I think we need to take the adjective off of that and say that anyone that has an expression we think of as an artist.
Yeah, right.
Because part of what that we, on the other hand of the decline of literary criticism, we have this upsurge of the of product.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
And that upsurge of product then goes back to that other problem we were talking about earlier, the persistence of cliche.
Yes.
And.
Which is what happens when you don't have aesthetes.
Yeah, I can get that one, but the oeuvre I can't get out of my mouth. Aesthete, I got that one.
Aesthete, but you don't have these guys. And it's usually guys, to be honest. But when you don't have those guys sifting through the dross, mm-hmm. that is what happens. Which is good in some ways, because it means that you have just the DWMs. But on the other hand, it's not so good, because it means that, again, you have more of the crap to search through before you get to the good stuff. But then again, you have more good stuff too. So it's like, I don't know.
Yeah. That's weird.
Am I still here?
Yeah, you're still there. Okay. It's just we're getting a weird echo, and then you're still kind of every now and then you'll cut out for a moment.
It just tells me, hey, you're having trouble with your online. Oh, no, it's fine. So,
do you want to disconnect and reconnect real quick?
I don't, would that help?
Yeah, sometimes that helps with Skype.
Okay.
So let's hang up, and I'll ring you back.
Okay.
So wait for me.
Okay.
Oh, we're back?
We're back, and better than ever.
I think it sounds a little better.
Okay, good. New, improved.
Yeah, like I said, sometimes with Skype, you gotta kick the tires a little bit.
You gotta bash your fist against the console like in the Millennium Falcon.
Right. That's what...
my whole thing... This is my whole question, though, which is what I think we wanted to center this around, is that... Okay, so yes, aesthetics popularity, it being a global village now, and everyone can see everyone. My question, the thesis of this latest the Esquire article was that genre fiction is now more important than literary fiction. Literary fiction is old hat. Genre fiction won, kind of thing. And there's no question anymore. No one even questions the fact that genre fiction can be high quality, or is high quality, just as often as literary fiction. And I don't agree with that. I don't see that happening. What I see is geek culture being more mainstream.
Right.
As Felicia Day now famously saying, "I'm the one that's cool." But I don't know if there's no stigma anymore at all for genre fiction. I don't think that's true at all. I think certain authors maybe certain series, like I would say Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes is not anymore considered pulp fiction.
Right.
It's now considered good literature. But I mean, there's a lot of stuff that is high quality that isn't really. It's still stigmatized, in other words.
Right.
And I don't know. I don't know. I just don't think. Well, what they're seeing is they're seeing a lot more vocal nerds, I guess, or more nerds are okay with being nerds, or more mainstream readers are okay with having some nerdy tastes as well in the mix.
Right. Right. And I think that weight of that is pushing the high quality genre work out into the mainstream, you know, like
right
like George Martin's, you know, the whole Game of Thrones, you know, Song of Ice and Fire, or whatever it's called. It's because that's so wildly popular, and because it's being geek culture is pushing that into the mainstream, we're realizing, wait, it's actually well written,
it's actually good books,
it's actually good literature. And but at the same time, when they make this claim that genre won, I don't think I agree with you. I don't think that's true. I think what's happened is that.
Well, I think that what's happening is that the bullies and the bullied are just kind of living together now, and it's okay. And there are still some people who are bullying, but they're not as important as they used to be. But there's still labels. It's still certainly a stereotype and a stigma, but it's just kind of not. It's like my senior year in high school. Suddenly, okay, I'm still a total nerd, but it didn't seem to be such a big deal anymore, and the bullies weren't bullying me anymore about it. So,
right.
In fact, they were auditioning for the plays too. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing.
And then you have poor Ishiguro, who just kind of, you know, inadvertently puts his foot in his mouth, and he's a fan.
Yeah.
Which was the whole basis of, I think, most of our arguments
in graduate school. Yeah, exactly. And Le Guin, too. Le Guin writes literary fiction, too.
Yeah. But, you know, and then she also, I think, by you know, rushing to defend fantasy and then just as quickly rushing to exclude Ishiguro's new work from it, it's perpetuating the problem.
Exactly. And her problem is that she is a scholarly elitist, totally, but she's also a fantasy genre writer.
Right.
For the most part, she writes other stuff too, but do you know what I'm saying? Like, she kind of has both things going on, and she's so used to, at this point, she is so used to having to rise up and just kind of defend herself that I think she might be kind of taking it a little too far because she's so used to that.
Right. I can understand that.
Which is not to, you know, I still think that she needs to sort of maybe educate herself a little bit more about Ishiguro's A, comment, B, work, before she starts to get all snippy about it. But again, you know, she's an older literary aesthete, she is totally literary elitist, and her work shows it. She's incredible as a writer, but it's just like, and again, you can just hear it. It's this rhythm. She's so, like me in grad school, like I'm so used to being like, no, don't just not read my stuff because it has swords and stuff in it. Just, you know, it's just this kind of, I think she just had a sort of a knee-jerk reaction to that.
Right. And I think maybe it's just out of habit.
And I'm not sure it doesn't still need to be said, is my whole thing. Like, all these articles, like, not even a big deal. What the hell? It's YouTube culture. We all like everything. Well, that's not exactly true. There are still stigmas. There's still labels. There's still...
Because we can't... What I fear is that, you know, if we run around saying that the genre wars are over and one side won, then... we're kind of throwing out the notion that anyone can legitimately criticize a piece of literature. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, I do see because what you're saying.
If I write literary fiction and I then criticize a piece of fantasy fiction, I'm suddenly engaged in trying to resuscitate a genre war when it just was that I didn't like that book. Not because it was fantasy, but because it was persistently cliched.
Right.
You know?
Determinedly derivative. Which then I proceeded to quote Mr. Hollow in my thesis and showed how he was derivative and how he was quoting from mythology. He's like, oh, no, the line in my poem came from a Western. I was like, determinedly derivative.
Yeah, but what I find, where the wars are still hot, the genre wars, so to speak, are still hot, are when you start drawing that line between traditionally published and self-published.
Oh, interesting. You think the genre wars are happening there? I would think more in the academic world, where you get cast basically in your poetry or in your prose. You know, departments.
No, I think it might still be happening there to a certain degree.
Like, if I went to get my MFA now as opposed to 15 years ago, good lord, it was that long ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
crap. Would my sword and sorcery be accepted now? I don't know. I don't know if my fiction teachers would still be like, oh, don't write this fantasy crap again. I don't know what to do with it.
Right.
No, I don't know if that would still be happening. It might. Of course, it depends on the school too. But you know what I'm saying.
Right. Right.
Anyway, no, go on about this. Yeah, the self-publishing versus the traditional publishing.
Well, I think
that kind of connects to the literary fiction being sort of more of a traditionally scholastic type thing, and the genre fiction being more of a pulp, you know, for the poor and the middle class kind of thing too. That's sort of a class issue, I think, there as well.
Right. And I think that's also part of it. I think the two kind of get conflated in a way, because I don't know if you're... Because the other thing that kind of cropped up on me as I was reading these articles and about the whole dust up was, was this blog post I put up last year called Why I Will Never Self-Publish.
Uh-huh.
And it was a huge, long thing. It might have been like 8,000 words. It was a big, maybe even 10. I don't know. It was a fucking big thing.
Did I read it?
Huh?
Did I read it and stick my friend Ian on you?
No, I don't think you read it at all. Evan Hundhausen read it.
Okay.
And then said to me, for someone who knows so much about publishing, why would you dismiss self-publishing? Why don't you give it a shot? And I wanted to write back to him and go, Evan, did you not read like the last third of the... I guess not.
Maybe not.
And then what the most interesting thing that happened after that post went up was that I had recently been friended on Facebook by this guy I had known since kindergarten and hadn't seen in about or heard from at all in about 20 years.
Wow.
Right. And this was the same guy who, when we were in kindergarten, he was always a small kid and was right away put into the gifted program. And I don't know, maybe psychologically he felt the need to compensate for his smallness by making sure everyone knew how smart he was.
Uh-huh.
And at least twice during the time that I knew him, he had to make sure that I knew that I would never be as smart as he was. Right? And, you know,
it's the brain kissing contest.
Yeah. And I was, you know, 7, 6 years old. You know, he's just like, okay, fine. I'll never be as smart as you are. La-di-da-di-da. You're on with my life. You know, but it still was kind of stick there in the background, you know, and he was kind of a dick a lot of the time. So he read that blog post because he now lives in Oklahoma and is like runs a newspaper or something down there.
Oh, that's
It's right wing.
Uh-oh. Ew.
Yeah. Wow. Your audio levels are fluctuating a little bit.
Oh, they are. Okay.
Yep. So he read the whole thing. He then forwarded it to, I guess I should back up a little bit. Before I wrote that and before he read it, we had had this little exchange on Facebook after he found me and sent me the friend invitation. I was like, okay, whatever. Accept.
Okay.
Because I'm a generous guy. I hadn't seen him in 20 years. Who knows what had happened to him in 20 years? I mean, he's married. He's got kids. You know, maybe he mellowed out a little bit. No, he didn't. But I'd made some comment about having a hard time finding an agent. And he goes, why don't you just self-publish? And I said, that's really not for me. He goes, well, I've got all these friends in science fiction, and they've done traditional thing, and they've done this. I've got all these friends that used to traditionally publish, and now they self-publish, and they're making all this money, and they get to keep all their rights. And I went, so I wrote back, and I said, well, what do they write? Well, science fiction, mostly. And I went, oh. And just left it at that. And then and that was what spawned me to write this post, why I will never self-publish. And he read that, and he then forwarded that blog post onto some of his science fiction self-publishing friends.
Uh-huh.
Who contribute to this website that's, when I looked at it, my first thought was, oh, this is what became of Pajama Media.
Media, yeah.
Right, which was supposed to be the right-wing version of HuffPost.
Uh-huh.
So, these people on this site, they admitted in their post that they'd only read about the first quarter of my massive essay.
Well, then shut up.
Right. And then they proceeded to eviscerate me in a tag team fashion. There were two of them. Right. And one of them assigned me what they thought was a denigrating nickname. So they would say, this writer says this, and then, oh, Ducky, doesn't Ducky know that, you know, whatever. And I thought to myself as I was reading that, one, this is really damn funny. Two, they're overreacting a whole lot and didn't read the whole thing.
Yeah.
And three, how did they know my high school nickname? You know, when I was on the journalism staff in high school, my friends on the staff called me Ducky because this was the late 80s and everybody pegged their pants. You know, they fold them up and rolled them up, whatever. And because I had big feet, you know, I looked like a duck.
Wasn't that the character in the, was it 16? No, which one was it? 16 Candles or some kind of one?
No. Well, it might have been Pretty in Pink.
I'm sorry.
Was Ducky.
Some Kind of Wonderful was the one where the ending was correct. Right. But Ducky wasn't Pretty in Pink. Thank you.
Right. So it might have been that, but it might have also been that animated movie Land Before Time with the dinosaurs. Yeah. Because the character that they called Ducky, when he was introduced into the whole thing, he had big feet. And, you know, all the other, and everybody in our little group of friends had been assigned a nickname from this movie. And when when the character Ducky pops up, he you know, hops up and he's like, I'm Ducky and I'm a big mouth. And they were like, that's Jason. Right. And so anyway, so they kept calling me, but they just took me to task for it. And it was like, oh, they only read the first quarter of the essay where I tried to break down the cost that I would incur to publish a, to self-publish a book the way I would want a book to be published. You know, with printed copies, professionally edited, a professionally designed cover, you know, market, a professional distribution and marketing. You still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I would want it this way so that it would not be easily distinguishable from a traditionally published book.
Right, right.
Well, they just, like, they... You know, they attacked my education, they attacked my writing, they, which all of which they didn't know anything about. You know, they're just all about denigrating me and calling me names because I was making an economic argument against self-publishing.
Just for you, though, too.
Right, because the whole essay was why I will never self-publish, not why you should never self-publish why no one should ever self-publish. And... One of the other distinctions that I went on later on in the essay to make was that self-publishing works best. And I even linked to a guy, I can't remember his last name right off the top of my head, but he has this whole website where it's dedicated to him doing these kind of analytics of Amazon ebook bestsellers.
Oh, that's interesting.
Particularly self-published ones. And at the same time, this guy is also one of the earning outliers for self-publishing. He's making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year self-publishing his series of science fiction books.
So do you equate the success in self-publishing with that kind of a genre?
Well, yes. And that's taken from his numbers that he reports. In his
what data does he get? Is it it's not just his own?
No, he's getting it. He's getting it from Amazon. He's getting the sales reports and everything like this. He's doing all of. I mean, he's doing legitimate analytics.
So he's showing that,
and he's saying that
genre works are selling more than the other kinds of works in that particular type of publishing.
Correct.
Oh, interesting.
And he talks about what who the earnings outliers are and tells you who they are. And the earnings outliers are the people that are making a lot of money in doing self-publishing. They're doing a couple of things. One, they're basically publishing serialized stories.
Right.
They're basically doing the written version of TV. They're cranking out a book every year or two books every year.
Or they're doing like short works, like short stories and like novellas and stuff like that.
Right, mid-sized stuff, whatever. And they're doing it inside specific genres. So what they're doing is they're tapping into an audience that will buy everything, whap, 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 fast as they can write it. And so
it's the TV, you're right, it's the TV watching audience, the ones that like, okay, I follow Green Arrow now. Right. And yeah.
And so
it tends to be genre, doesn't it?
Right. It tends to be genre because genre provides you, even if you are aware of and pay attention to and avoid the persistence of cliche, genre still provides you a certain formula.
Tropes.
And certain tropes that can make it easier for you to write a little bit more fast. And if you come up with your own particular formula for your particular story, you can, and a set of recurring characters, you don't have to continually rebuild the world. You build it out, you know, in your head or in the background, and then you just, it's like the old the shared universes that they used to do in mass market paperbacks for science fiction before the internet came along, like Jerry Pornell's War World. you know, or some, the stuff that Larry Niven would do and things like that.
The Thieves' World.
Right, or the Mangzin Wars, you know, that type of stuff. Where you have somebody who makes a Bible, says these are the basic rules of the universe, and then people come in and write short stories or novellas according to those rules, and they put it in a little anthology and it goes out there. Well, this is what one person, and these are the earnings, these are the most of the earning outliers for for self-published books. They've got a genre, and they turn out books, you know, at a really rapid pace.
Is there still a stigma associated with self-publishing too? Like the people that self-publish can't get traditionally published?
Well, if you take a look at the actual numbers, then yes, there it's it, but it's not a social stigma. It's just an economic stigma. There are a lot of people that self-publish, and the same percentage even now that rise to the surface are the same percentage that always rose to the surface out of self-publishing.
So now you've got two stigma both going on at the same time. You've got the sci-fi is just pulp one, and then you've got the self-publishers. Self-publishing means that you couldn't get through the peer review. Stigma
right.
Both. So then you've got two things that are making...
But we could go on and on about the whole getting through the peer review. I mean, the fact that... The reason self-publishing is so huge right now is because there are so few publishers out there that are able to buy manuscripts and pay writers enough that they can just write.
Right, yeah.
'Cause right now, there are five big publishers.
I was going to say, there are so few publishers, period.
Penguin Random House, Houghton Mifflin, Harcourt, Macmillan, Simon & Schuster, Hachette.
Yep.
I think that's it.
And their branches. The branches they're on.
Well, you can't count their imprints, because the imprints are still the parent.
Yeah.
Right. So you have those five big publishers. And... Then you have the small presses like mine, Unbridled, who can't pay the kind of advance that would allow me to, you know, take a part-time job or do whatever and write more. I still have to have a job. Most writers, even the mid-listers with the big houses need a job.
Yeah.
Right? But you have all of this content and this hunger for stories out there, and so, but the gatekeepers have gotten so, I wouldn't say pickier, but they've gotten smaller in number.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
One editor, you know, at Tor can only edit so many books a year. Right.
And it's so expensive to physically publish too, anymore.
Mm-hmm. You just got really loud and then really quiet. And then
didn't I? Oh, yeah. Wow. We'll have fun editing this one.
Yeah, well, we'll figure, we'll put it up rough and just leave it. It's a special impromptu episode.
Oh,
so.
Dear.
But, so, anyway, so he sent that out there. They ranted and raved about me. And then, like a coward, he puts comments on my blog post referencing this quote from the guys that eviscerated me, but doesn't leave his own name and doesn't give me a link to the blog post, right? I found the blog post by copying a line from what he quoted.
And then Googling it.
And Googling that line and finding the blog post.
Yeah.
And when I found the blog post, his own friends.
Wait, kids, this is how I find out whether you've been plagiarizing or not. It's a very easy thing to do. Anyway, go on.
But his own friends kind of ratted him out because in their first paragraph, they said, our friend, you know, should I give his name out?
I don't know. That's your judgment call.
We'll for the sake of, I mean, he'll know who he is. For the sake of this, we'll just call him, Captain Joe.
Okay.
Right there in their first paragraph, we got the link for this article from Captain Joe, and we thought, bah! Right?
Yeah.
I was like, dude, You haven't seen me in 20 years, and the first thing you do when you get in touch with me is set me up to get beat up over the head by a bunch of douchebags.
Feed me to the piranha trolls.
You know? Oh, my God. But the funny thing was that when in his comment, he said, well, I don't understand your rant against genre. And I went back and I read my thing, and I thought, I wasn't ranting against genre. I was saying, I don't write fast enough. And on top of that, I don't write a genre for me to make money self-publishing.
Uh-huh.
If I were going to self-publish, all the stuff that I would want, you know, edited, you know, professionally designed book, all this other good stuff, I would have to take out a loan for at least, you know, $3,000 to $4,000.
Right.
And, you know,
I hear you're giddy.
Yeah. And the critics, the people who were criticizing me, were saying, you could earn that back, you know, by selling X number of copies. And I go, and I was like, they didn't read the rest of the thing, which where it takes me 3 years to get a book finished.
Right, yeah.
Right. So, yes, you know, if I put one book out and I spend a year doing nothing but marketing myself online, I'll be able to earn back, you know, my loan that I took out. But then I've got to go write the next book.
Yeah, right.
And the long tail isn't going to be dense enough for me to live off of or consider myself having made a money. And now by the time I get done with another book, I'm going to have to take out a loan to...
Again.
That's not financially responsible.
Right.
Not when I owe $80,000 in student loans.
Uh-huh.
So... But what I found interesting, though, was that it's in that arena where I think the genre wars, in a way, are still raging.
I see.
Because you have, and I think it's that battleground that's pushing, in a way, is pushing the acceptance of people like George Martin. And the Harry Potter books and other fantasy and science fiction stuff, because people that are paying attention to the publishing industry, they see what's moving in the self-publishing realm, what people are buying.
Yeah, that's true.
Because it's cheap. This is the same thing that you know, and because we've had the decline of the public criticism, because we've had this increase of access.
Fewer filters, more access, yeah.
That what the publishing industry and these people in New York who have their own little specific sheltered specialness, let's call it what it is. It's kind of, and, you know, you want to pull in other parts of problems with the publishing and writing industry right now, where it seems to be that the only people that have access to it are those people from upper white middle class East Coast families who those kids can go through college without any student debt and then, you know, live in an apartment with six people in New York and take those $30,000 a year, you know, publishing jobs.
Yeah, right.
Right. And so that's a... So what you're seeing when you have these writers writing for Esquire or whatever on the East Coast is you have the kind of literary version of white privilege.
Yep, I see what you're saying.
Right? And so they don't see the war that's going on out here in the sticks.
And do you think that MFA programs are kind of feeding into that too? I mean, we still have the whole Iowa Writers Conference.
I think to a certain extent, yes, because... You know, programs like Iowa, the older programs, even the one here in town, Wichita State University, is kind of they're pushing that academic literary criticism thing. All that public literary criticism hasn't really gone away. It's isolated itself in the academy.
Yeah.
And so the academy is still turning out, you know, that group, but they're staying in the academy or they're getting into traditional publishing. But what you see, what most people are seeing, is that people do like to read. People will, if it's inexpensive enough and it gives them that little bit of thrill, they will they will support certain writers, you know, to the tune of bumping those writers into the upper classes and hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, like this Hugh Howey, that's his name.
Well, and like I've noticed too, and I've remarked on this before, that now you don't call them book series, you know, with accompanying merchandise. You call it a franchise immediately. Like the first time the first episode of a TV show comes out, or the first time the first novel in a series comes out, it's called a franchise, like from the get-go.
Right.
It's like all about, it's a franchise now. Now it is a brand. It is a franchise. It is something that people, but that's saying that people are going to buy everything that has to do with it. Like
right.
Now you read Rothfuss's first two books in his trilogy, and there's like all of the fan fiction, the fan art, and all of the stuff around it is selling with the book. Does that make sense? Like,
it's, oh yeah,
it's like this big, huge, like,
you know, and that's
marketing thing.
And that's the thing, is that that's kind of like the hidden superpower of the genres of fantasy, of science fiction, and things like that, is that they lend themselves to that franchising, to the serialization.
Because nerds love things so much that they will take and buy, and like they will get everything that has to do with it. Like they'll buy everything that has to do with the thing that they love, and they get very enthusiastic about it.
Right,
and that means money will change hands.
Exactly, and
whereas a literary fiction fan is not necessarily going to be like that. They're not going to be rabid like that.
Right, and what I see a lot, at least from when I got when I was attacked by these people, was that there was, I guess this kind of reverse snobbery.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh yeah, it's nerd rage.
You know, and that's why I still think that, you know, these people that are jacking themselves off with this whole idea that the genre wars are over, they need to make they need to make a big public display like I did, and then see what the fuck happens.
Oh, you mean, yeah.
Right? I mean, I wasn't too concerned about...
Girl. I mean, that's kind of what happened, right?
Right. Just take someone who feels like they're on the margins, like a lot of these self-published genre writers who feel that they're on the margin, that they're neglected, that they're not taken seriously, that, you know, that they are denigrated or whatever. And someone like me, who, you know, is a fan of genre, although not, you know, the all-out geeky, go to comic cons, dress up and do whatever type of fan, Jesus Christ, I have a season pass to Arrow. You know, I've watched a few episodes of The Flash. I every time a damn Marvel comic book movie comes out, I'm there with my mother. Because my mother if my mother had been born in our generation or younger, my mom would be at the cons, and she would be dressed up like Black Widow. I mean,
she'd be cosplaying for sure.
Oh yeah. You know, that's what's so weird. My my mother's a comic book geek, right? Okay. And because I know every time a comic book movie comes out, I know who my date is. It's my mom, because she wants to go see him.
Nice.
But, you know, but that's not what comes out of me. That's not what I'm interested in writing about. Those aren't the I like them. I enjoy them. I understand. The good ones. I understand their cultural relevance. I understand why, you know, the X-Men or Spider-Man is culturally significant because of what they represent. That kind of alienated outsider who has a special skill type of thing. You know, that's and why that appeals to a certain set of people, because it appeals to me. And I've always thought of writing as, for me, as a way to explain the world. And for me, that means addressing the world. in my fiction and not inventing another world as a stand-in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, that doesn't
and
mean I'm...
there are certain, like, especially, well, there are certain sci-fi, especially because what sci-fi does is it takes the world as we know it and projects it into the future. It's like,
Right.
what if? So sometimes they, those good books bring up questions about this world, and sometimes the fantasy, by creating a new world, hits at something in this world a little in a different way.
Right.
But yeah, but that's not, it's not, doesn't mean that they don't hit the real world problems well enough, or that yours doesn't get deep enough because it's only about the real world. Do you know what I'm saying? It's just all
right.
different perspectives and different directions to come at.
Right. Yeah, it's a way of, it's a way of processing the information. It's kind of the, I guess what I want to say is depth of metaphor, if that makes sense.
Well,
we're talking
just,
we're talking about giant macro metaphor, because when you're dealing with fantasy and science fiction, it's taking real, you can take real world conflicts and issues and problems, put them into a science fiction setting or a fantasy setting, and what you're doing is you're creating this giant macro sized metaphor.
Right.
Whereas with literary fiction, the metaphor is smaller, because it's still an imagined, fictional, made up representation of the real world. There are certain things. Dawn, sweetie, can't sit on my lap. She's very upset. She's being ignored right now. But the distance between the representation and the actual thing is shorter between literary fiction and the real world, and
or it's like a window or a mirror, as opposed to,
well, more like a funhouse mirror, because fiction, by its very nature, because you can compress and expand and manipulate time, and because you can do certain things with character. I mean, Tom Robbins in Even Cowgirls Get the Blues, it's mostly a realist type of book. It doesn't contain a lot of fantasy elements, except for the fact that the main character has exceptionally large thumbs.
Right.
So it takes this one exaggerated element. But other than that, it's still a pretty accurate representation of the world as we...
So it can be a window or a mirror or a telescope or a funhouse mirror.
Right.
Whereas the genres tend to be more paintings of it, or...
Well, not only that, but abstractism. I mean, it's like the difference between a Picasso and the real world.
I don't know if I would...
That might be a little too distorted.
I don't know if I would say that fantasy... I can
maybe
see fantasy more, but if that's so far... I don't think it's so far gone. I think it has deep-seated... It has to, at least the good stuff.
Maybe it's more...
deep-seated roots.
Maybe it's more a Gauguin versus the real world. Right? I mean, Gauguin didn't put eyeballs on chins and things like that.
No,
I mean,
it's Monet, right? No, really, because I was just teaching about this a couple of weeks ago. It's an impression of an emotion, and it was considered trash and not finished work.
Right.
And now it's considered high art.
But yeah, and you know, it's not that.
Anyway, our conclusion is that good books are good books, and shut the hell up.
Right.
Really.
I think that's everybody's conclusion. But.
Yeah.
But what they're calling the genre wars, or the way they try to set them up, I think they're still happening.
Yes, I agree.
And they're still from this very low spot, influencing the rest of us.
Yeah.
Because literary writers, Ishiguro, me, anybody with an internet connection, can find Hugh Howey's, you know, analytics out there on his website and can see that there is this tremendous freaking audience of readers out there that are habitually, repeatedly, in vast numbers, buying and reading books through Amazon.
Right, yes. Uh-huh.
Or other e-reading services, you know, Smashwords, whatever, stuff like this. But they're not going out and buying the product that the big five publishers or even the smaller publishers are putting out.
No, not really.
And people are like going, why, what's going on? And writers, of course, being slightly more sensitive people than publishers. Now, that's not, of course, Fred Ramey would probably hear this and go, I don't know.
They're the artists, right?
But Fred was my editor at Unbridled, my publisher. And, you know, it's not to say that what I was going to say was, you know, editors aren't as sensitive and publishers aren't, but that's not true. There are a tremendous amount of editors and publishers who are just as sensitive to the movements and trends of the publishing world as writers are. Just not a lot of them are at, you know, the big five.
Right. Yeah.
Because the big five publishers are run by accountants now. And accountants, we know, are really asocial. they're barely human.
Oh, dear.
Anyway, I have a couple of friends who are accountants, and maybe they'll listen to this podcast. I don't know.
Hey, I've insulted you. You should tell us. I've insulted you as a group of people.
Right.
You should listen now.
But no, but what I'm saying is that the writers are the first ones to kind of react to this kind of secret knowledge that there's this whole giant untapped pool of people that like to read things, but they're not reading my book.
Right. Yes, they're reading all kinds of genre.
They're reading a serialized genre book that's self-published by a guy or a woman or an animal who you know, the extent of their editing process is to get the high school kid down the block to edit it in exchange for a case of beer. And
I think that's not always true too, though.
That's not always true. You're right. I mean, but what I'm saying is that there's people who are outliers, earnings outliers in self-publishing, they're smart. They know the business.
Yeah.
That's how they end up becoming outliers, because they put out a relatively good product. But and even Howie says this himself, he said self-publishing is not for everyone.
Do you think that self-publishers are perforce the ones that are the outliers, like you're saying? Do you think that they, because of all that, tend to be the slightly better quality than, say, the bestsellers of traditionally published?
Like, in general?
Do you find the Danielle Steeles and the Dan Browns in self-publishing as much, or were the Daniel Steeles and Dan Browns be slightly better written in self-publishing because of all that?
They would be about the same.
Okay.
What matters is, what depends is, it's about a certain amount of determination and time and scale. Because a lot of the writers that are traditionally published that you and I really think are awful, you know, like Dan Brown in particular.
I love getting you to bitch about Dan Brown. It's so fun.
But in those types of writers in particular. Now, remember, Dan Brown got his start before e-readers.
Yes.
So would someone... And because of the celebrity model and the model that traditional publishers are on, yes, there's still a chance that someone who doesn't have very much skill will get traditionally published and make a shitload of money, right?
It happens all the time.
Happens all the time. It's still going to happen because what the publisher is looking for is something that they can put out there and sell a lot of stuff on because that need, they need to keep the lights on.
Right.
Right? So, yeah, I think there is not, there's probably not much quality difference between someone like Dan Brown and someone who might be an earnings outlier as a self-publisher.
Just a question, just to throw out there. It's just interesting that you're bringing this whole thing into the whole thing. It's an interesting, not side argument, but I guess parallel discussion.
Right. Well, to me, it's all kind of interconnected.
Yeah.
Because I honestly believe that the reason that genre has broken through, in a way, into the mainstream. Is one, yes, geek culture, but also because of this push from the self-publishing ranks. And traditional publishers and the writers who are with traditional publishers seeing this upsurge and going, if we push this book, you know, with some dragons and some swords and some magic and some whatever, it's another revenue stream.
Uh-huh.
Right? I mean...
you know... Yeah. Yeah.
She wants it on my lap right now. But
now my cats can hear it.
Right. If there weren't this self-publishing push... if there weren't this self-publishing push and interest, you know, in the ebooks for fantasy and science fiction...
Well, and it's such the access, too. I mean, that means that, like, so many people are getting published, and it's so accessible.
Right, but if it wasn't for that, I don't think... If it wasn't for that, combined with the rise of geek culture, then George Martin's books probably would have still ended up with a traditional publisher, but they would not have caught the interest of a Hollywood screenwriter. They would not have gotten the marketing push from the publisher to move into the mainstream.
Well, and look at what happened with Lord of the Rings. Once they made those into movies, it was like...
Right, but and those were already,
yeah,
you know, more or less canonized.
I mean,
they might not have been taught in English curricula, but you would have been hard-pressed to find a published literary writer who hadn't read them at least when they were a kid.
Right, right.
Whether they were taken seriously in the academic canon or not. So, I mean, the Lord of the Rings were pretty well established, but once you had a good movie, that just sparked it again. And that also...
The franchise thing again.
Right, the franchise thing. And because that franchise thing, because of the readers flocking to self-published franchises, because they like that type of storytelling and the decline of literary reading, you have the publishers scrambling for cash. And I think it's money that's made genre books more mainstream.
This is storytelling too. I think you're right about that. It's the revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the...
What you cut out there. Right after it's the revenue. You're gone. Come back. You're back for a second. I'm going to hang up and call you back.
Yay. Okay. Yeah, like I was saying, it seems to have this connection. The deepest stories that we tell. There's this great, it's a Carnegie Medal acceptance award speech by Philip Pullman.
Mm-hmm.
Just find it online on his website. It's great. He talks about why children's literature is awesome. Again, he's sort of defending his genre a little bit. And what he says is that people want story. They want good stories. They want to know what happens next. And they're like, he's like, they'll even read bad books to get stories if the good books supply them. And he talks about literary fiction in a little bit where he says, you know, the writers tend to want to show you how good a writer they are, as opposed to tell you what happens next.
Right.
And that's why people are going to the genres, is because they get good stories from it. And sometimes, not always, this is just, again, the stereotype of literary fiction, is that literary fiction is all about the word choice and all about the, like, watching the author do a juggling act of language instead of actually telling a story.
Right.
Which, you know, if anyone who's read your book will know, that's not true, but, you know.
We need to re-kick Skype again, because now you're really sounding weird. You're all there, okay, but you're sounding weird. Oh, good grief, internet connection. I will call you right back.
Up to anyway, right? Okay.
Yeah, we're getting close to it, but I'll call you right back.
Okay. Not good. Still weird.
Still kind of wonky.
Wonky.
Yeah.
I wonder why.
Let me try this one more time. Instead of hitting the video thing, I'm gonna hit the phone thing, and hopefully it'll still connect to you. Because last time it didn't seem to want to.
Okay.
Hold on just a second.
Alrighty, how's that?
I think that's gonna work better.
Okay.
I think, yeah. There we go. Didn't even give us the option for video that time, so.
Okay, cool.
Maybe that'll work better because it's processing less.
Yeah.
We were talking about Pullman's speech.
Yeah.
And, oh, right. The whole, that's one of the persistent cliches, I think, of literary fiction.
Right. Is that it's about the writing and not about the story.
But at the same time, it has some basis in truth, but I think what I want to call it off the top of my head is the Finnegan's Wake syndrome. Right? Which is where there's a story.
Ulysses.
There's a story to Finnegan's, excuse me, there's a story to Finnegan's Wake.
Oh, I mean Joyce's Ulysses. I took an entire semester of that.
Right.
Thing.
And, but, you know, if.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly. Yep, it's about,
Well, that's just it, is that you have these things, you have what you had a lot with the modernists, what you had with this assumption, this misunderstanding, I want to call it, of literary fiction being about nothing.
Yes, or the opposite, which is genre fiction being only storytelling but with crappy writing.
Right, but I'm talking specifically about the literary thing here, is that what you had, with particularly with modernism and social realism and stuff like this, and the push through the 20th century, was about trying to shrink down the story to the smallest movement.
Oh yeah, yeah. One of your articles is talking about the micro storytelling.
Right. And, but I don't. I mean, I didn't read all of that guy's part, but this is something that I've been thinking about. It's because, you know, Laura and I used to talk about this. Is that we said that even if you have two people sitting quietly in a room, something's happening.
Yes.
And you have, and those writers that tried to reduce their story down to two people sitting quietly in a room, when they failed at it and it still managed to get published, that's what created this whole horrible misconception about literary fiction being about nothing, is because they did not have the right, they were missing something in there.
Right, yeah, yeah.
The language was too dense. Like Finnegan's Wake, the language is just too dense for someone to quickly and easily grab what the story is, what the through line is.
It's like too many words, like the comment in Amadeus, too many notes.
Right, or I think, and people that are afraid of literary fiction should not read something like The Rings of Saturn by W.G. Sebald.
Right.
You know, because you kind of have to sit with that thing to catch what the through line is, what the story is, what happens next. This kind of weird stream of consciousness, you know, walking story is the best way to describe it. It's utterly fascinating. I'm enraptured by it. But I know I could never recommend that to someone whose favorite book was, you know, Stranger in a Strange Land.
Well, similarly, if someone come people and people do this, they come up to me, they're like, okay, so I want to start reading some fantasy. What should I start with? Should I start with Tolkien? I'm like, hell no. Not unless you enjoy reading the Elder Eddas, or unless you enjoy reading the Bible. I mean,
Right.
no. Start with something that will tell you a story. Start with Wizard of Earthsea, or, yeah. There are certain things where it's like, okay, yeah. They do, I don't know if this is, makes any sense, but they do this stereotype really well, or they're what the bad stereotype is based on,
Right.
except it's awesome.
Right.
Like Tolkien, there's so that's what the determinedly derivative thing is. Like every fantasy novel for a long time, many years, and even now, it's just a Tolkien knockoff, or it's a narration. It's a narration of your D&D game, which of course the D&D system is based off of Tolkien's world.
Right.
So like, yeah, no, don't start with that.
Yeah.
Like see where the roots are, and know that they're doing it really well, but
Right.
so many people wanted to too, that it's like
Well, they have this, they have the same damn problem with the detective genre. Is
Yeah, oh
that
yeah.
who the fuck can write a detective book without addressing Hammett and Chandler?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I sat down and I tried to read a few, you know, detective books at one point, and then I picked up Chandler, and it was like it dawned on me, this was the guy that did it first.
Yes. Yeah.
This other
This is the one
thing,
that's
this
doing
is
it
what
well.
Hammett did first, and this is what Chandler did first, and then everybody else seems to be trying to, if they're not paying attention, they're just redoing Hammett and Chandler.
They're trying to. It's funny. I'm a Sherlock Holmes nerd, and I'm like especially into it these days, and it's funny, like all the police procedurals that are on TV, like you get so many of the, and I love this character, the eccentric genius consulting with the police force, with the
Right.
official police force, right? The unofficial genius with the eccentricities that's consulting the police force. And there are some of them that are, they're all derivative of Sherlock Holmes, all of them. And yet, some of them do it really well, and some of them do it really crappily. Like all the CSI stuff. Okay, well, maybe Gil Grissom and the first CSIs were kind of okay, but it's getting to be, oh, like they're like, the franchise, quick, the franchise, everyone run. And so you get the certain gems like Lie to Me or early Mentalist, where Mentalist just needed to die before it has,
Right.
or.
And that's and that
They just go too far, and it's the same thing with the, well, that's just the same thing with any kind of stereotype of the genre, of any genre, though. It's just
Right.
true.
And it goes back to that something we
You
talked about
can't
earlier.
judge an entire genre based on the ones that are trying hard and not getting it.
Right. And we should make sure that we apply that same thing to literary fiction.
Well, yeah, like we were just saying, like the ones
Because
that are all about the words and they don't know how words work and so they don't do it right.
right. You know, and they just you know,
Yeah.
that's, you know, kind of the my general rule is I got into an argument. I interviewed one of the instructors in the MFA program here at Wichita State a couple of years ago, and we were talking about, you know, what was the fiction writer's, you know, primary obligation. And I said, well, it's your primary obligation is to entertain. And he shot back,
How did that go down?
and he shot back with, well, I don't think that's it. And he pulled back. I think it was. I want to attribute it to Henry James just because he's on my mind. But I think it was someone else. He said, "No, the first obligation of the fiction writer is to be interesting." And I thought, was this is this a semantics argument, or is this your way of of, you know, keeping yourself distant from a genre that you don't want to be associated with. You know what I'm saying?
That's one other thing that Pullman said in that same speech. He said, once a writer starts to become interesting, that's when they're not at all interesting. That's when the storytelling suffers.
Right.
And didn't Mamet say that in one of our readings for one of Keith's classes?
Maybe. I don't know. But yeah, that's...
The yeah. minute you try and start to be interesting, that's the minute you are completely boring.
Yeah. And it's the thing. You know, yes, you know, entertainment is... And I talked about this when I did a presentation at an art chatter event here in Wichita about a year ago, was that, you know, entertainment is... should be your primary concern, because that's the Trojan horse. If you're entertaining and you also contain with that entertainment, you know, meaning, significance, relevance, empathetic imagination,
if all it's the, well done,
all of those elements that we traditionally, almost stereotypically, associate with literary fiction and not with genre. If you jam all of that important shit up into entertainment, you sneak it in on people that you know, are sitting around going, I don't want to have to think when I read. I just want to be entertained. Yeah, okay, I'll entertain you, but I'm going to sneak in some stuff on you that...
Yeah, that the whole just thing, yeah. Entertainment does not necessarily happen.
Yeah.
It's edutainment. See, I don't think that entertainment necessarily equals... not art, though. That's the thing.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think that's maybe what your professor was worried about. It's like, it should be to entertain. No. That's a low thing. That's a lowbrow thing. That's what pulp novels do. They entertain. No. Entertainment can be art. In fact, art should be, right? I mean,
yeah.
Otherwise, what are you doing? You're like Kandinsky and his upper pyramid of artists only understanding themselves. It's like, well, no.
Right.
The whole point of art is to communicate, right? Is to
exactly, and that goes back to, I think, one of my big fundamental, you know, things that I've been on my own little missional hobby horse thing that I've been on for 20 years, is that, you know, part of the reason I think people don't read is because we teach it wrong.
Uh huh.
Right, and
it's a chore.
Right, it becomes a chore, and it becomes, they teach it as if there's one right way to interpret this story, and if you don't get it, then the implication is that you're stupid. And
right.
So if you get out of school thinking that the so-called canonical books, the dead white guys, the important literature, you're not smart enough to get it, but you have this Jones to read, you're going to go pick up that thing that insults your intelligence, because you've been conditioned to think, well, that's all I get, is this
yeah.
is what I understand, because the person tells me three times that this thing is an address. You know that story. That's my Dan Brown story, for
yes,
fuck's
I know.
Sake. God. Oh, man. Okay, this will be the... We need to wrap it up here in a minute, but fuck.
Dan Brown thing was the entirely uninhabited upstairs, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, and not only that, but there was this other passage where, you know, the character's walking down the street in the Da Vinci Code, and he picks up a business card off the street and flips it over. And then in the text on the page, Dan Brown recreates the business card, so you can see that there's an address written on the business card.
It's an address.
And then down below it, in parentheses, to signify thought, he goes, it's an address! And I was like, don't insult my intelligence, you fucking cocksucker!
You just showed us.
You know?
I think that should be the title of this one. Don't insult my intelligence, you fucking cocksucker. I think that should be it.
Don't insult my intelligence, you fucking cocksucker.
I think that's right. It. I think you nailed it.
And that's, yeah, that might be it. Yeah, because... That's the whole point behind all of these genre wars is, you know,
yes.
someone's thinking their intelligence has been insulted.
Someone thinks that, yeah, exactly, that it's not good enough for their smarts or whatever.
You know,
the smart club won't include certain things. which is not true. Smart Club includes everything.
As long, so as, it's, dumb, as, long as it's smart.
Dumb club. Yeah, well, so it's the Dumb Club. The Dumb Club has all kinds of stuff, too. But Smart Club can include any number of things.
Well, the recording might be a touch spotty, but I think it was a really good discussion. Thanks for hopping on and spending an hour and a half blabbing at me about it. I'm glad you sent that article to me.
I'm glad, too. I'm glad you sent all of these to me. You should link to all of them.
Oh, well, I'm going to put the show notes for this one will be longer than most all of the other ones.
Oh, yeah.
I might even include a link to my Why I Will Never Self-Publish thing and the article that smacked me around. Just
definitely do that. I would like to see that myself. Oh, and link to the Pullman thing, too.
Okay, send me the link to that.
Okay.
I'll include it. Anything you want me to link to, I'll include it. This will be a link happy show notes page.
It's a linky link.
Yay!
Well, cool. Well, thank you. I'm glad we recorded this conversation instead me of too. Merely chatting.
Yeah, I think it. Well, I was needing some episodes. I'm recording one tonight, and I've got one tomorrow night, so it'll be cool.
Ah, very cool.
Thanks, Jen.
All right. Thanks, Jason.
All right, so there you have it. My conversation with Jen about the genre wars. Hope you had fun with that one. I had fun talking to Jen, even though it often sounds like I have Tourette's syndrome in some variety. I don't mean to offend people with Tourette's syndrome, but, you know, it takes a while for my brain to engage my mouth sometimes. We've got some new streams coming, so be on the lookout for the next one with Stephen McClurg. It's an exercise podcast, so join in, have some fun. And then the podcast with Gavin, and then we'll have interviews. Yay! So come back in 2 weeks, or a week.